Hello again. This is Mrs. English, and I am going to be reading to you from Book 6 of Virgil's Aeneid, the Robert Fitzgerald translation. And remember, you need to have your book copy with you, and this is the Robert Fitzgerald translation, the Aeneid, Book 6. This is the last of the books that are comparable with the Odyssey. Starting in Book 7, we'll be compared with the Iliad. So this is the last of the traveling part. And here we're going to see all types of exciting things in Book 6. He's going to have a trip to the underworld. Every great hero has to take a trip to the underworld. And Aeneas is going to run into somebody, one of his men, who was recently dead, and he doesn't know he's dead. Aeneas tries to embrace his mother, and of course he can't. And we're going to see a procession of mythological people, as well as some of his Greek companions who were killed at Troy during their homecomings. Trojan companions. There's the description of Virgil's underworld, which is not always consistent. There are two passages to get into the underworld in the Aeneid, and we'll hear that. We'll also find out that he kind of believes in reincarnation and that the soul progresses from one thing to another. We'll have this long pageant of Roman history, this long list of everything that's going to happen over the next 1,000 years. And of course, Virgil's telling this from the first century BC, but he's telling it as though he's telling it from 1,000 BC. And telling the history of Rome. So he's quite accurate because it's already happened. We're going to find that the entrance to the underworld, he needs to get a hold of the golden bough, and the exit is called the Twin Gates of Sleep, and they're very magical, they're mysterious, and we don't exactly what's going on. This is his final attempt to communicate with Dido and finds out that she's dead, she's in the underworld, she won't even turn around and look at him. And then his father Anchises will speak to him from the underworld and explain all about the destiny of Rome. And here's where the real propaganda, beautiful, beautiful propaganda comes in, where Virgil really gives his own political ideas. He puts them into the mouth of his wise father Anchises, who's already dead, and he talks about the Roman nation. They should be merciful, not violent. Even when they conquest, they have to remember what they stand for and what he and his beliefs, to let his beliefs guide him. And this speech is really meant to justify what the Roman Empire has been doing in Virgil's time, the first century BC, just conquesting all the nations. And the idea is that they are the ones who were meant to conquer. They were set up to conquer. They're supposed to conquer. And so it kind of defends all of their invasions by arguing that they bring law, they bring justice, and they use warfare to pacify people and to battle them down and to establish peace. And it kind of selects these Roman people as the chosen ones and the just ones. And of course, to get into the underworld, they're going to arrive in Italy. So this is going to take place on Italy, and he'll arrive near Cumae, and he's going to go to the Sibyl's Cave. There's a Cumaean Sibyl, and that would be near modern-day Naples. You can still go. You can go into that, the Cumaean Cave, which is actually pretty cool. The Cumaean Sibyl will meet the priestess of Apollo, you know, and she utters this message with her leaves and all of that. And he wants to go see his dad in the underworld, and she tells him how to get the golden bough. You know, will it let him pluck a branch or not? And then he's going to go down there. Then he's going to find out there's a trumpeter they didn't even know was dead. This guy has to be buried. And he's going to meet Charon, the ferryman who takes people across the River Styx. And they'll find out Palinurus. They see Palinurus and it's like, what are you doing here? And they find out he fell asleep, he drowned, and he didn't get buried, so they're going to have to bury him. We meet Cerberus. We have poor Dido won't even look at him. And we have a list of famous warriors. And we learn about the Elysian Fields, the River Lethe, that's where the River of Forgetfulness, you can't remember any of that, and the dead drink from the river, and then they kind of assume new identities, and that would be reincarnation. And so then we have Anchises' very long speech to Aeneas in this underworld, and we learn about Alban kings, and you know, Romulus and Numa, and we learn about Romulus and Augustus. We learn all types of things. We even learn about Marcellus, who was the heir of Augustus, but Marcellus died young in 23 BC, and Augustus had just begun his reign in 27 BC. So we find all of these cool things. Then he comes back through the gates of sleep, and his father Anchises leads him back to this ivory gate. So it's all really cool. Book 6. So grieving and in tears, he gave the ship her head before the wind, drawing toward land at the Eubonian settlement of Cumae. Ooh. So Cumae. Ships came about, prows pointing seaward, anchors biting to hold them fast, and rounded sterns indented all the water's edge. The men debarked in groups, eager to go ashore upon Hesperia, the western lands, Italy. Some struck seeds of fire out in the veins of flint, and some explored the virgin woods, lairs of wild things, for fuel, pointing out, too, what streams they found. Aeneas, in duty bound, went inland to the heights where overshadowing Apollo dwells, and nearby, in a place apart, a dark, enormous cave, the Sibyl feared by men. In her Delian god of prophecy, inspires uncanny powers of mind and soul, disclosing things to come. So she tells the future. Here Trojan captains walked to Diana of the Crosswoods Road and entered under roofs of gold. They say that Daedalus, when he fled the realm of Minos, dared to entrust himself to stroking wings and to the air of heaven, unheard of path, on which he swam away to the cold north at length, to touch down on that very height of the Chalcedonians. That's the story of the Minotaur and the seven youths. Here on earth again he dedicated to you, Phoebus Apollo, the twin sweeps of his wings. Here he laid out a spacious temple. In the entranceway, Androgynous's death appeared. Then Cecrops' children ordered to pay in recompense each year the living flesh of seven sons. That's what the Minotaur demanded. The urn from which the lots were drawn stood modeled there, and facing it upon the opposite door, the land of Crete emerged from the sea. Here the brutish act appeared, Pasiphae being covered by the bull in the cow's place, then her mixed breed, her child of double form, the Minotaur, get of unholy lust. Here, too, that puzzle of the house of Minos, the maze none could untangle, until, touched by a great love shown by a royal girl, he, Daedalus himself, unraveled all the baffling turns and dead ends in the dark, guiding the blind way back by a skein unwound, a skein of wool or something. In that high sculpture, you, too, would have had your great part, Icarus, had grief allowed. Twice your father had tried to shape your fall in gold, but twice his hands dropped. Here the Trojans would have passed on and gazed and read it all, had not Achates, whom they had sent ahead, returned now with the priestess of Apollo and of Diana, goddess of the crossroads, Deiphobe, the Sibyl, Glaucus's daughter. Thus she addressed the king. The hour demands no lagging over sights like these. Instead, you should make offering of seven young bulls from an ungelded herd, and seven again well-chosen ewes. With these words for Aeneas, orders his men were quick to act upon, the priestess called them to her lofty shrine. The cliff's huge flank is honeycombed, cut out in a cavern, perforated 100 times, having 100 mouths with rushing voices, carrying the responses of the Sibyl. Here, as the men approached the entranceway, the Sibyl cried out, "Ooh, now is the time to ask your destinies." And then, "The god! Look there! The god!" And as she spoke, neither her face nor hue went untransformed, nor did her hair stay neatly bound. Her breast heaved, her wild heart grew large with passion, taller to their eyes, and sounding now no longer like a mortal, since she had felt the god's power breathing near, she cried, "Slow are you in your vows and prayers, Trojan Aeneas, are you slow? Be quick, the great mouths of the god's house, thunderstruck, will never open until you pray." Her lips closed tight on this. A chill ran through the bones of the tough Teucrians, but their king poured out entreaties from his deepest heart. "O Phoebus, Apollo, god who took pity on the plain of Troy, who guided Paris's hand, his Dardan shaft against the body of Aeacides," that's Achilles, because Paris, who struck Achilles, "as you led on, I entered all those seas, washing great lands, and then the distant tribe of the Massilians at the Surtees edge. Now we take hold at last of Italy, that slipped away so long. Grant that the fortune of Troy shall have pursued us this far only. Are all you gods and goddesses as well, who took fence at Ilium in our pride, and last rightly you may spare Pergamum's children? Most holy prophetess, for knowing things to come, I ask no kingdom other than fate allows me. Let our people make their settlement in Latium, with all Troy's wandering gods and shaken powers. Then I shall dedicate a temple here to Phoebus and Diana of the crossroads, ordering festal. Diana, of course, is Artemis, to Apollo and Artemis, brother and sister, of the crossroads, ordering festal days in Phoebus's name, so he'll establish holidays. A holy place awaits you in my kingdom, where I shall store your prophecies, your dark revelations to my people, and appoint a chosen priesthood for you, gracious one. But now commit new verses to the leaves, or they may be confused, shuffled and whirled, but plain winds, by plain winds, chant them aloud, I pray. So Aeneas doesn't want her to write him on the leaves because maybe the wind will blow them around. He wants her to just talk. Then he fell silent. But the prophetess, whom the bestriding god had not yet broken, stormed about the cavern trying to shake his influence from her breast, while all the more he tired her mad jaws, quelled her savage heart and tamed her by his pressure. In the end, the cavern's 100 mouths, all of themselves, unclosed to let the Sibyl's answers through. You sir, now quit at last of the sea's dangers, from whom still greater are in store on land. The Dardan race, the Trojans, will reach Lavinian country, the Roman area of Italy. Put that anxiety away, but there will wish they had not come. Wars, vicious wars, I see ahead, and Tiber flowing blood, the Tiber River. Simois, Xanthus, Dorians encamped, you'll have them all again, with an Achilles, child of Latium, he too, goddess born. And nowhere from pursuit of Teucrians will Juno stray, while you go destitute, begging so many tribes and towns for aid. The cause of suffering here again will be a bride foreign to Teucrians, a marriage made with a stranger. Never shrink from blows, boldly, more boldly, where your luck allows, go forward, face them. A first way to safety will open where you reckon on it least, from a Greek city. These were the sentences in which the Sibyl of Cumae, from her shrine, sang about her riddles, echoing in the cave, dark sayings, muffling truths, though Apollo pulled her up raging, or else whipped her on, digging the spurs beneath her breast. As soon as her fit ceased, her wild voice quieted. The great soldier Aeneas began to speak. So Apollo kind of possessed the Cumaean Sibyl, and then he unpossessed her. So Aeneas now is talking. No novel kinds of hardships, no surprises loom ahead, sister. I foresaw them all, went through them in my mind. One thing I pray for, since it is here, they say, one finds the gate of the king of underworld, the shadowy marsh that wells from Acheron. May I have leave to go to my dear father's side and see him. So he wants to go to the underworld. Teach me the path, show me the entrance way, through fires and with 1,000 spears behind. I brought him on these shoulders, rescued him amid our enemies. He shared my voyage, bore all the seas with me, hard nights and days of menace from the sea and sky, beyond the strength and a lot of age, frail though he was. Instead, he prayed this very prayer. He told me that I should come to you and beg it humbly. Pity a son and father, gracious lady. All this is in your power. Hecate, the goddess of the underworld, she's of the witches and the moon. It's a crossroads, too. It's a trivia. It's three ways. Hecate gave you authority to have and hold Avernus Wood. If Orpheus could call his wife's shade up, relying on the strings that sang loud on his Thracian lyre, if Pollux, you remember Pollux and Castor were Helen's brothers who shared immortality? If Pollux redeemed his brother, taking his turn at death, so often passing back and forth, why name the heroes Theseus and Hercules? By birth, too, I descend from Jove on high. So Aeneas is making the case that he's demigod. He deserves his chance to go down into the underworld. While in these terms he prayed and pressed the altar, breaking in, the Sibyl said, ooh, line 185, offspring of gods by blood, Trojan Anchises' son, the way downward is easy from Avernus. Black Dis's door stands open night and day, but to retrace your steps to heaven's air, There is the trouble. There is the toil. So it's easy to get in, hard to get out. A few whom a benign Jupiter has loved, or whom fiery heroism has borne to heaven, sons of gods could do it. All midway are forests. Then Cocytus, thick and black, winds winds through the gloom. But if you feel such love and such desire to cross the Stygian water twice, to view the night of Tartarus twice, if this mad effort's to your liking, then consider what you must accomplish first. A tree's deep shade conceals a bough whose leaves and pliant twigs are all of gold, a thing sacred to Juno of the lower world. The whole grove shelters it, and thickest shade in dusky valleys shuts it, and yet no one may enter hidden depths before the earth unless he picks this bough, the tree's fruit with its foliage of gold. This is the golden bough. Proserpina, the queen of the underworld, decreed this bough as due her, should be given into her own fair hands when torn away. In place of it, a second grows up without fail, all gold as well, flowering with metallic leaves again. So lift your eyes and search, and once you find it, pull away the bough. It will come willingly, easily, if you are called by fate. If not, with all your strength, you cannot conquer it, cannot lop it off with a sword's edge. A further thing is this, your friend's dead body. Ah, but you don't know, lies out there unburied, polluting all your fleet with death. So Messenius, their Trojan trumpeter, has to go get burned, polluting all your fleet with death while you are lingering, waiting on my counsel here at my door. First, give the man his rest, entomb him, lead black beasts to sacrifice. Begin with these amends, then in due course you'll see the Stygian forest rise before you, regions not for the living. She fell silent, closing her lips. With downcast face and eyes, Aeneas turned from the cavern to the shore, dark matters on his mind. Steadfast Achates walked beside him with deliberate pace and equal anxieties. The two exchanged in shifting conversation many guesses as to that friend, now dead, now to be buried, so the prophetess had said. Then suddenly, as they came down to the dry beach, they saw Messenius, that's their trumpeter, robbed of life by early death. Their own Messenus, a son of Aeolus, never surpassed at rousing fighting men with brazen trumpet, setting Mars afire. Once he had been great Hector's adjutant, going forward at Hector's side in battle, brilliant with trumpet and with spear as well. After Achilles took the life of Hector, this gallant soldier joined Dardan Aeneas in allegiance to no lesser cause. That day by chance, as he blew notes out of a hollow shell, making the sea sing back in his wild folly, he dared the gods to rival him. And of course, you should never dare the gods. Then Triton, envious, if this can be believed, caught him and put him under the surf amid the rocks offshore. All who were there clamored around the body in lament, Aeneas, the good captain, most of all. In haste then, even as they wept, they turned to carry out the orders of the Sibyl, racing to pile up logs for the altar pyre and build it sky high. Into the virgin forest thicket of wild things went the men, and down the pitch pines came. The bitten ilex rang with axe blows, ash and oak were split with wedges, mighty rowans were trembled down the steps. Aeneas himself went first in all this labor, cheering his fellows on with implements like theirs in hand, but grimly in his heart he wondered, studying the unmeasured forest, and fell to prayer. If only the golden bough might shine for us in such a wilderness, as all the prophetess foretold was true. Messenius, in your case, only too true. The words were barely uttered when two doves, in casual flight out of the upper air, came down before the man's eyes to alight. Remember the prophetess, the Cumaean Sibyl, said he had to have two doves? On the green grass, and the great hero knew these birds to be his mother's. Joyously he prayed, because remember, Aphrodite, Venus, is her birds are the doves. Joyously he prayed, "Oh, be my gods, if there's a way, wing on into that woodland where the bough, the priceless bough, he wants the golden bough, shadows the fertile ground. My divine mother, do not fail your son in a baffling time." Then he stood still to see what signs the doves might give, or where their flight might lead him. And they fed, and then flew on, each time as far as one who came behind could keep in view. And when they reached the gorge of sulphurous Avernus, so this is a river that smells of sulphur, so it stinks, first borne upward through the lucent air, they glided down to their desired rest, the two-hued tree where glitter of gold filtered between the green boughs, like mistletoe that in the woods in winter thrives with yellowish berries and new leaves, a parasite on the trunk it twines around, so bright amid the dark green ilex shone the green leafage, rustling in light wind. Aeneas at once briskly took hold of it, and though it clung, greedily broke it off, then carried it to the Sibyl's cave. So Aeneas did break off a piece of the golden bough. And he's heading off back to the Sibyl. Meanwhile, the Teucrians on the shore wept for Maecenas, doing for thankless dust the final honors. First they built up a giant pier, enriched with pitch pine and split oak, with sober boughs alongside and dark cypress in front. On top they made a blazon of bright arms. One group set water boiling over flames, then washed the cold corpse and anointed it, groaning aloud, and laid it out when mourned on a low couch with purple robes thrown over it. A hero's shrouding, bearers then took up as their sad duty the great bier. With eyes averted in their father's ancient way, they held the torch below. Heaped offerings blazed up and burned, food, incense, oil, and bowls, and when the flame died and the coals fell in, they gave a bath of wine to the pier's remnant, thirsty ash. Then, picking out the bones, Cranius enclosed them in an urn. The same priest with pure water went three times around the company, asperging them. The aspergillium, it remember, is the thing you pick up and shake with wine or water. The Catholic priest still does that today. But the aspergillium around the company, asperging them with cleansing drops from a ripe olive sprig, and spoke the final words. Faithfully then, Aeneas heaped a great tomb over the dead, placing his arms, his oar, his trumpet, there beneath a promontory named for him. Maecenium now and always, age to age. All this accomplished, with no more ado, he carried out the orders of the Sibyl. The cavern was profound, wide-mouthed and huge, rough underfoot, defended by dark pool and gloomy forest. Overhead, flying things could never safely take their way. Such deathly exhalations rose from the black gorge into the dome of heaven. The priestess here placed four black bullocks, wet their brows with wine, plucked bristles from between the horns, and laid them as her first offering on the holy fire, calling aloud to Hecate, supreme in heaven and Erebus. Others drew knives across beneath and caught warm blood in bowls. Aeneas, by the sword's edge, offered up to Night, the mother of the Eumenides, and her great sister Earth, a black-fleeced lamb, a sterile cow to thee, Proserpina. Then for the Stygian king he lit at night new altars where he placed over the flames entire carcasses of bulls and poured rich oil on blazing viscera. Only see, just at the light's edge, just before sunrise, earth rumbled underfoot, forested ridges broke into movement, and far howls of dogs were heard across the twilight as the goddess nearer and nearer came. Ooh, away, away, the Sibyl cried, all those unblessed, away, depart from the grove. But you, Aeneas, enter the path here, and unsheath your sword. There's need of gall and resolution now. She flung herself wildly into the cave mouth, leading as he strode boldly at her heels. Gods who rule the ghosts, all silent shades and chaos and infernal fiery stream and regions of wide night without a sound, may it be right to tell what I have heard. May it be right and fitting by your will that I describe the deep world sunk in darkness under the earth. Now dim to one another in desolate night, they walked on through the gloom, through Dis's homes all void and empty realms, as one goes through a wood by a faint moon's treacherous light, when Jupiter veils the sky and black night blots the colors of the world. Before the entrance, in the jaws of Orcus, grief and avenging cares have made their beds, and pale diseases and sad age are there, and dread and hunger that sways men to crime. Line 380, and sordid want in shapes to affright the eyes, and death and toil, and death's own brother sleep, and the mind's evil joys on the door sill, death bringing war, and iron cubicles of the Eumenides, and raving discord, viperish hair bound up in gory bands. We're supposed to be getting scared. In the courtyard, a shadowy giant elm spreads ancient boughs, her ancient arms where dreams, false dreams, the old tale goes, beneath each leaf, cling and are numberless. There too, about the doorway, forms of monsters crowd, centaurs, twi-formed, Scyllas, hundred-armed Briareus, and the Lake Lernaean Hydra, hissing horribly, and the Chimera, breathing dangerous flames, and Gorgons, Harpies, huge Chiron, triple-bodied ghost. Here, swept by sudden fear, drawing his sword, Aeneas stood on guard with naked edge against them as they came. If his companion, knowing the truth, had not admonished him how faint these lives were, empty images, hovering bodiless, he had attacked and cut his way through phantoms, empty air. The path goes on from that place to the waves of Tartarus's Acheron. Thick with mud, a whirlpool out of a vast abyss boils up and belches all the silt it carries into Cocytus. Here the ferryman, a figure of fright, keeper of waters and streams, is Charon, foul and terrible, his beard grown wild and white, his staring eyes all flame, his sordid cloak hung from a shoulder knot. Alone he poles his craft and trims the sails, and in his rusty hull ferries the dead. Old now, but old age in the gods is green. Here a whole crowd came streaming to the banks, mothers and men, the forms with all life spent, of heroes great in valor, boys and girls, unmarried and young sons, laid on the pyre before their parents' eyes, as many souls as leaves that yield their hold on boughs and fall through forests in the early frost of autumn. So there's many souls here on the other shore as there are leaves that fall in the fall. Or of as migrating birds from the open sea that darken heaven when the cold season comes and drives them overseas to sunlit lands. There all stood begging to be at the first to cross and reached out longing hands to the far shore. But the grim boatmen now took these aboard, now those, waving the rest back from the strand. In wonder at this and touched by the commotion, Aeneas said, "Tell me, sister, what this means, the crowd at the stream. Where are the souls bound? How are they tested so that these turn back, while those take oars to cross the dead black water?" Briefly, the ancient priest just answered him, "Cocytus is the deep pool that you see, the swamp of Styx beyond, infernal power by which the gods take oath and fear to break it." Remember the river Styx? They can't make an oath and break it, or they, you know, they have to, I don't know, die for 9 years or something, and fear to break it. All in the nearby crowd, you notice here are pauper souls, the souls of the unburied. Charon's the boatman. Those the water bears are souls of buried men. He may not take them shore to dread shore on the horse currents there until their bones rest in the grave, or till they flutter and roam this side 100 years. They may have passage then, and may return to cross the deeps they long for. Anchises' son, Aeneas, had halted, pondering on so much, and stood in pity for the soul's hard lot. Among them he saw two sad ones of unhonored death, Leucapsis and Lucian fleet's commander, Orontes, who had sailed the windy sea from Troy together, till the southern gale had swamped and whirled them down, both ship and men. Of a sudden he saw his helmsman, Palinurus, going by, who but a few nights before, on course from Libya as he watched the stars, had been pitched overboard astern. As soon as he made sure of the disconsolate one, in all the gloom, Aeneas called, "Which god took you away from us and put you under, Palinurus? Tell me, in this one prophecy, Apollo, who has never played me false, falsely foretold you'd be unharmed at sea and would arrive at the Ausonian coast. Is the promise kept?" But the shade said, "Phoebus's cauldron told you no lie, my captain, and no god drowned me at sea. The helm that I hung on to, duty bound to keep our ship on course, by some great shock chanced to be torn away, and I with it went overboard. I swear by the rough sea I feared less for myself than for your ship, with rudder gone and steersman knocked overboard. It might well come to grief in big seas running. 3 nights heavy weather out of the south on the vast water tossed me. On the fourth dawn I sighted Italy, dimly ahead as a wave crest lifted me. By turns I swam and rested, swam again and got my footing on the beach. But savages attacked me as I clutched at a cliff top, weighted down by my wet clothes. Poor fools, they took me for a prize and ran me through. Surf has me now and sea winds washing me close inshore. By heaven's happy light and the sweet air, I beg you, by your father, and by your hopes of Iulius's rising star, that's little Ascanius, Iulius, Julius, that he will rise as a star. This is, of course, presaging Julius Caesar. I beg you by your father and by your hopes of Iulius's rising star, deliver me from this captivity, unconquered friend. Throw earth on me, you can. Put into Vale a port, or if there be some way to do it, if your goddess mother shows a way, and I feel sure you pass these streams and Stygian marsh by heaven's will, give this poor soul your hand. Take me across. Let me at least in death find quiet haven." When he had made his plea, the Sibyl said, From what source comes this craving, Palinurus? Would you, though still unburied, see the Styx and the grim river of the Eumenides, or even the river bank, without a summons? Abandon hope by prayer to make the gods change their decrees. Hold fast to what I say to comfort you, your hard lot. Neighboring folk in cities up and down the coast will be induced by portents to appease your bones, building a tomb and making offerings there on a cape forever named Palinurus. The Sibyl's words relieved him, and the pain was for a while dispelled from his sad heart, pleased at the place name. So the two walked on down to the stream. Now from the Stygian water the boatman, Charon, seeing them in the silent wood and headed for the bank, cried out to them a rough, uncalled-for challenge. "Who are you, in armor, visiting our rivers? Speak from where you are. Stop there. Say why you came. This is the region of the shades and sleep and drowsy night. It breaks eternal law for the Stygian craft to carry living bodies. Never did I rejoice, I tell you, letting Alcides, Heracles, Cross, or Theseus, or Pirithous, demigods by paternity, though they were invincible in power, one forced in chains from the king's own seat, the watchdog of the dead, and dragged him away trembling. The other two were bent on carrying our lady off from Dis's chamber. They wanted Persephone. This the prophetess and servant of Amphrysian Apollo briefly answered. Here are no such plots, so fret no more. These weapons threaten nothing. Let the great watchdog at the door, Cerberus, howl on forever, terrifying the bloodless shades. Let chaste Proserpina remain at home in her uncle's house. The man of Troy, Aeneas, remarkable for loyalty, great in arms, goes through the deepest shades of Erebus to see his father. If the very image of so much goodness moves you not at all, here is a bow. And at this she showed the bow. This had been hidden, held beneath her dress. You'll recognize it. Then his heart, puffed up with rage, subsided. They had no more words. His eyes fixed on the ancient gift, the bow, the destined gift, so long unseen, now seen, he turned his dusky craft and made for shore. There, from the long thwarts where they sat, he cleared the other souls and made the gangway wide, letting the massive man step in the bilge. The leaky coracle groaned at the weight and took a flood of swampy water in. At length, on the other side, he put ashore the prophetess and hero in the mire, a formless ooze amid the gray-green sedge. Great Cerberus, barking with his triple throat, makes all that shoreline ring as he lies huge in a facing cave. Seeing his neck begin to come alive with snakes, the prophetess tossed him a lump of honey and drugged meal to make him drowse. Three ravenous gullets gaped, and he snapped up the sop. Then his great bulk subsided and lay down through all the cave. Now, seeing the watchdog deep in sleep, Aeneas took the opening. Swiftly he turned away from the river over which no soul returns. Line 575. Now voices crying aloud were heard at once. The souls of infants wailing at the door of the sweet life they were to have no part in. Torn from the breast, a black day took them off and drowned them all in bitter death. Near these were souls falsely accused, condemned to die. Not without a judge or juryman had these souls got their places. Minos reigned as the presiding judge, moving the urn, and called a jury of the silent ones to learn of lives and accusations. Next were those sad souls, benighted, who contrived their own destruction, and as they hated daylight, cast their lives away. So those who committed suicide. How they would wish in the upper air now to endure the pain of poverty and toil. But iron law stands in the way, since the drear, hateful swamp has pinned them down here, and the Styx that winds nine times around exerts imprisoning power. Not far away, spreading on every side, the fields of mourning came in view, so called since here are those whom pitiless love consumed with cruel wasting, hidden on paths apart by myrtle woodland growing overhead. In death itself, pain will not let them be. Here he saw Phaedra, Procris, Eriphyle, sadly showing the wounds her hard son gave, Evadne and Pasiphae, at whose side Laodame walked, and Canis, a young man once, a woman now, and turned again by fate into the older form. Among them, with her fatal wound still fresh, Phoenician Dido wandered the deep wood. The Trojan captain paused nearby, and knew her form dim in the dark, as one who sees early in the month, or thinks to have seen the moon rising through cloud all dim. He wept and spoke tenderly to her. So Aeneas sees Dido.
Dido, so forlorn. The story then that came to me was true, that you were out of life, had met your end by your own hand? Was I the cause? I swear by heaven's stars, by the high gods, by any certainty below the earth, I left your land against my will, my queen. The gods' commands drove me to do their will, as now they drive me through this world of shades, these moldy wastelands, and these depths of night, and I could not believe that I would hurt you so terribly by going. Wait a little, do not leave my sight. Am I someone to flee from? The last word destiny lets me say to you is this. Aeneas, with such pleas, tried to placate the burning soul, savagely glaring back, and tears came to his eyes. But she had turned, with gaze fixed on the ground, as he spoke on, her face no more affected than if she were immobile granite or Marpesian stone. At length she flung away from him and fled, his enemy still, into the shadowy grove, where he whose bride she once had been, Sychaeus, joined in her sorrows and returned her love. So now Dido's down there with her first husband, Sychaeus. Aeneas still gazed after her in tears, shaken by her ill fate, and pitying her. Line 640. With effort he then took the given way, and they went on, reaching the farthest lands where men famous in war gather apart. Here Tydeus came to meet him, and then Parnathopaeus, glorious in arms, Adrastus, then a pallid shade. Here, too, were Dardans, long bewept in the upper air, men who died in the great war. And he groaned to pick these figures out in a long file, Glaucus, Medon, Thersilochus, besides Antenor's three sons, then the priest of Ceres, Polybetes, then Idaeus, holding still to his war car, holding his old gear. To right and left they crowd the path and stay, and will not have enough of seeing him, but love to hold him back, to walk beside him, to hear the story of why he came. Not so Agamemnon's phalanx, chiefs of the Danaans, seeing the living man in bronze that glowed through the dark air, they shrank in fear. So the Greek heroes shrink in fear from Aeneas. Some turned and ran as once when routed to the ships, while others raised a battle cry, or tried to, mouths agape, mocked by the whispering cry. Here next he saw Deiphobus, Priam's son, mutilated from head to foot, his face and both hands cruelly torn, ears shorn away, nose to the nose holes, lopped by a shameful stroke. Barely knowing the shade who quailed before him, covering up his tortured face, Aeneas spoke out to him in his known voice, Deiphobus, gallant officer in high Teucer's line, who chose this brutal punishment? Who had so much the upper hand of you? I heard on that last night that you had fallen, spent after a slaughter of Pelasgians, fallen in piled-up carnage. It was I who built on Rhoeteum Point an empty tomb and sent a high call to your soul three times. Your name, your armor, marks the place. I could not find you, friend, to put your bones in earth in the old country as I came away. And Priam's son, this Deiphobus, replied, You left undone nothing, my friend, but gave all ritual due, Deiphobus, due a dead man's shade. My lot and the Laconian woman's ghastly doing, that would be Helen, sank me in this hell. These are the marks she left me as her memorial. You know how between one false gladness and another we spent that last night. No need to remind you, when the tall, deadly horse came at one bound, with troops crammed in its paunch above our towers, she made a show of choral dance and led our Phrygian women, crying out on Bacchus here and there, but held a torch amid them, signaling to Danaans from the height. Worn by the long day, heavily asleep, I lay in my unlucky bridal chamber, and rest profound and sweet, like the rest of death, weighed on me as I lay. Meanwhile she, my distinguished wife, moved all my arms out of the house, as she had slipped my sword, my faithful sword, out from beneath my pillow, opened the door and called in Menelaus, hoping no doubt by this gift to him, her lover, to blot out infamy out. Why hold back from telling it? The two burst in the bedroom, joined by that ringleader of atrocity, Ulysses, Odysseus, of the wink-dings line. Oh, gods, if with pure lips I pray, requite the Greeks with equal suffering. But you, now tell me, what in the world has brought you here alive? Have you come for your sea-wandering, and did heaven direct you? How could harrying fortune send you to these sad, sunless homes, disordered places? At this point in their talk, Aurora, borne through high air, on her glowing, rosy car, had crossed the meridian. Should they linger now with stories, they might spend the allotted time. But at Aeneas' side, the Sibyl spoke, warning him briefly, Night comes on, Aeneas. Ooh, we use up hours grieving. Here is the place where the road forks. This is the crossroads in Dis. On the right hand, it goes past mighty Dis's walls, Elysium way, our way. But the leftward road will punish malefactors. doctors, taking them to Tartarus. Deiphobus answered her, "Reverend Lady, no need for anger, Reverend Lady. I'll depart and make the tally in the darkness. Full again. Go on, sir. Glory of us all. Go on. Enjoy a better destiny." Line 735. He spoke, and even as he spoke, he turned away. Now of a sudden Aeneas looked and saw to the left under a cliff wide buildings girt by a triple wall, round which a torrent rushed with scorching flames and boulders tossed in thunder, the abyss's fiery river. A massive gate with adamantine pillars faced the stream, so strong no force of men or gods in war may ever avail to crack and bring it down. And high in air an iron tower stands, on which Tisiphone, her bloody robe pulled up about her, has her seat and keeps unsleeping watch over the entranceway by day and night. From the interior groans are heard, and thud of lashes, clanking iron, dragging chains. Arrested in his tracks, appalled by what he heard, Aeneas stood. "What are the forms of evil here, O sister? Tell me, and the punishments dealt out. Why such a lamentation?" Said the Sibyl, "Ooh, light of the Teucrians, it is decreed that no pure soul may cross the sill of evil. When, however, Hecate appointed me caretaker of Avernus Wood, she led me through heaven's punishments and taught me all. This realm is under Cretan Rhadamanthus' iron rule. He sentences, he listens, and makes the souls confess their crooked ways. How they put off atonements in the world with foolish satisfaction, thieves of time, until too late, until the hour of death. At once the avenger, girdled with her whip, Tisiphone, leaps down to lash the guilty, rile writhing snakes held out on her left hand, and calls her savage sisterhood. The awaited time has come. Hell gates will shudder wild on shrieking hinges. Can you see her now, her shape as doorkeeper upon the sill? More bestial just inside the giant Hydra lurks with 50 black and yawning throats. Then Tartarus itself goes plunging down in darkness, twice as deep as heaven is high, for eyes fixed on ethereal Olympus. Here is Earth's ancient race, the brood of Titans, hurled by the lightning down to roll forever in the abyss. Here, too, I saw those giant twins of Aeolus, who laid their hands upon great heaven to rend it and to topple Jove from his high seat. And I saw, too, Salamnius paying dearly for the jape of mimicking Jove's fire, Olympus's thunder. Shaking a bright torch from a four-horse car, he rode through Greece and his hometown in Elis, glorying, claiming honor as a god, out of his mind, to feign with horses' hooves on bronze the blast and imitable bolt. The Father Almighty, amid heavy cloud, let fly his missile, no firebrand for him, nor smoky pitch-pine light, and spun the man headlong in a huge whirlwind. One had sight of Tydeus too, child of all mothering earth, his body stretched over 9 whole acres, while an enormous vulture with hooked beak forages forever in his liver, his vitals rife with agonies. The bird, lodged in the chest cavity, tears at his feast, and tissues growing again get no relief. As for the Lapiths, need I tell, Ixion, Pirithous, and the black crag overhead, so sure to fall it seems already falling. Golden legs gleam on the feasters' couches. Dishes in royal luxury prepared are laid before them, but the oldest fury crouches near and springs out with her torch, her outcry if they try to touch the meal. Here come those who, as long as life remains, held hate brothers hateful, beat their parents, cheated poor men dependent on them, also those who hugged their newfound riches to themselves and put nothing aside for relatives. A great crowd this, then men killed for adultery, men who took arms in war against the right, not scrupling to betray their lords. All these are hemmed in here awaiting punishment. Best not inquire what punishment, what form of suffering at their last end overwhelms them. Some heave at a great boulder or revolve spread eagle hung on wheel spokes. Theseus cleaves to his chair and cleaves to it forever. Phlegius in his misery teaches all souls his lesson, thundering out amid the gloom, "Be warned and study justice, not to scorn the immortal gods." Here's one who sold his country, foisted a tyrant on her, set up laws or nullified them for a price. Another entered his daughter's room to take a bride forbidden him. All these dared monstrous wrong and took what they dared try for. If I had 100 tongues, 100 mouths, a voice of iron, I could not tell of all the shapes their crimes had taken, or their punishments. All this he heard from her who long years had served Apollo. Then she said, Come now, be on your way and carry out your mission. Let us go faster. I can see the walls, the Cyclops forges built, and facing us, the portico and gate where they command us to leave the gifts required. On this, the two in haste strode abreast down the dark paths over the space between and near the doors. Aeneas gained the entrance, halted there, aspersed his body with fresh water drops, and on the sill before him fixed the bow. Now that at last this ritual was performed, his duty to the goddess done, they came to places of delight, line 855, to green parkland, where souls take ease among the blessed groves, wider expanses of high air endow each vista with a wealth of light. Souls here possess their own familiar sun and stars. Some train on grassy rings, others compete in field games, others grapple on the sand. Feet moving to a rhythmic beat, the dancers group in a choral pattern as they sing. Orpheus, the priest of Thrace, in his long robe accompanies, plucking his seven notes now with his fingers, now with his ivory quill. Here is the ancient dynasty of Teucer, hot heroes high of heart, beautiful scions, born in greater days, Aeolus, Asarchus, and Dardanus, who founded Troy. Aeneas marvels to see their chariots and gear far off, all phantom, lances fixed in earth and teams unyoked, at graze in the wide plain. All joy they took alive in cars and weapons, as in the care and pasturing of horses, remained with them when they were laid in earth. He saw how vividly, along the grass, to right and left, others who feasted there, and chorused out a hymn praising Apollo. Within a fragrant laurel grove, where Po sprang up and took his course to the world above, the broad stream flowing on amidst the forest. This was the company of those who suffered wounds in battle for their country, those who in their lives were holy men and chaste, or worthy of Phoebus in prophetic song, or those who bettered life by finding out new truths and skills, or those who to some folk by benefactions made themselves remembered. They all wore snowy chaplets on their brows. To these souls, mingling on all sides, the Sibyl spoke now, and especially to Messeus, the central figure toward whose towering shoulders all the crowd gazed. Line 895. Tell us, happy souls, and you, great seer, what region holds Anchises? Where is his resting place? So the Sibyl, the Cumaean Sibyl, is down there in the Elysian fields with Aeneas and is asking this one guy, you know, where is Aeneas' father, Anchises? Do you know where he lives? Where is his resting place? For him we came to ferry across the rivers of Erebus. And the great soul answered briefly, none of us has one fixed home. We walk in shady groves and bed on river banks and occupy green meadows fresh with streams. But if your hearts are set on it, first cross this ridge, and soon I shall point out an easy path. So saying, he walked ahead and showed them from the height the sweep of shining plain. Then down they went and left the hilltops. Now Aeneas' father, Anchises, deep in the lush green of a valley, had given all his mind to a survey of souls, till then confined there, who were bound for daylight in the upper world. By chance, his own were those he scanned now, all his own descendants, with their futures and their fates, their characters and acts. But when he saw Aeneas advancing toward him on the grass, he stretched out both his hands in eagerness, as tears wetted his cheeks. He said in welcome, have you at last come? Has that loyalty your father counted on conquered the journey? Am I to see your face, my son, and hear our voices in communion as before? I thought so surely, counting the months I thought the time would come. My longing has not tricked me. I greet you now. How many lands behind you? How many seas? What blows and dangers, son? How much I feared the land of Libya might do you harm. Aeneas said, your ghost, your sad ghost, father, often before my mind impelled me to the threshold of this place. My ships ride anchored in the Tuscan sea. But let me have your hand. Let me embrace you. Do not draw back. At this his tears brimmed over and down his cheeks, and there he tried three times to throw his arms around his father's neck. Three times the shade, untouched, slipped through his hands, weightless as wind and fugitive as dream. Aeneas now saw at the valley's end a grove standing apart with stems and boughs of woodland rustling, and the stream of Lethe running past those peaceful glades. Around it souls of a thousand nations filled the air, as bees. What are they like, all these souls? As bees in meadows at the height of summer hover in home on flowers and thickly swarm on snow-white lilies, and the countryside is loud with humming. At the sudden vision, shivering at a loss, Aeneas asked, what river flowed there, and what men were those in such a throng along the riverside? His father Anchises told him,
the souls for whom a second body is in store. So that would show that Virgil probably believed in reincarnation. A second body is in store. Their drink is water of Lethe, and it frees from care in long forgetfulness. For all this time, I have so much desired to show you these and tell you of them face to face, to take the roster of my children's children here, so you may feel with me more happiness at finding Italy. What must we imagine, Father? There are souls that go from here aloft to upper heaven and once more return to body's dead weight? The poor souls, how can they crave our daylight so? My son, said Ascanius to his son Aeneas, I'll tell you not to leave you mystified, Anchises said, and took each point in order. So now, and this is Anchises' speech to Aeneas in the underworld, and it's a long speech, and it starts here with line 973. First, then, the sky and lands and sheets of water, the moon's bright moon's globe, the Titan sun and stars, are fed within by spirit, and a mind infused through all the members of the world makes one great living body of the mass. From spirit comes the races of man and beast, the life of birds, odd creatures the deep sea contains beneath her sparkling surfaces, and fiery energy from a heavenly source belongs to the generative seeds of these. So far as they are not poisoned or clogged by mortal bodies, their free essence dimmed by earthiness and deathliness of flesh. This really is a classical Greek interpretation of the body and the soul. This makes them fear and crave, rejoice and grieve. Imprisoned in the darkness of the body, they cannot clearly see heaven's air. In fact, even when life departs, on the last day, not all the scourges of the body pass from the poor souls, not all distress of life. Inevitably, many malformations, growing together in mysterious ways, become inveterate. Therefore, they undergo the discipline of punishment and pay in penance for old sins. Some hang full length to the empty winds. For some, the stain of wrong is washed by floods or burned away by fire. We suffer each his own shade. We are sent through wide Elysium, where a few abide in happy lands, till the long day, the round of time fulfilled, has worn our stains away, leaving the soul's heaven-sent perception clear, the fire from heaven pure. This is almost a type of purgatory before Catholicism. These other souls, when they have turned time's wheel 1,000 years, the god calls in a crowd to Lethe stream, that there, unmemoried, they may see again the heavens and wish re-entry into bodies. So they have to wander around for 1,000 years, if they're not buried and if they've, you know, done bad things. Anchises paused. He drew both son and Sibyl into the middle of the murmuring throng, then picked out a green mound from which to view the souls as they came forward one by one, and to take note of faces. Come, he said, what glories follow Dardan generations in after years, and from Italian blood what famous children in your line will come, souls of the future living in our name. I shall tell clearly now, and in the telling teach you your destiny. That one you see. So what's happening here now, starting with line 1020, is that, of course, Virgil's writing from the 1st century BC. He died 19 BC, so this is written sometime before that. And he is giving 1,000 years of Roman history. And so he's giving it as though he is describing it 1,000 years earlier and telling the future, when of course, he's just rewriting the past. That one you see, the young man leaning on a spear, unarmed, he has allotted place nearest the light. He will be first to take the upper air. Silvius, a child with half Italian blood and an Alban name, your last born, whom your wife, Lavinia, late in your great age, will rear in forests to be king and father of kings. So Aeneas just learned the name of his wife-to-be is Lavinia, and his last child will be called Silvius, and who will be a father, a king, and be father of kings. Through him our race will rule in Alba Longa. Next him is Procas, pride of the Trojan line, and Capys too, then Numitor, then one whose name restores you, Silvius Aeneas. So then there will be someone even named after you. Both in arms and piety, your peer, if ever he shall come to reign in Alba. What men they are, and see their rugged forms with oak leaf crowns shadowing their brows. I tell you, these are to be found Nomentum Gabi, Fidane Town, Calatia's Hilltop Towers, Pometi, Fort Innes, Bola, Cora, names to be heard for places nameless now. Then Romulus, fathered by Mars. This is the famous Romulus and Remus. Then Romulus, fathered by Mars, Ares, will come to make himself his grandfather's companion, Romulus, reared by his mother, Ilia. In the bloodline of Asacrus, do you see the double plume of Mars fixed on his crest? See how the father of the gods himself now marks him out with his own sign of honor? Now look, my son, under his auspices, illustrious Rome will bound her her power with earth, her spirit with Olympus. She'll enclose her seven hills with one great city wall, fortunate in the men she breeds. So this is the destiny of Rome, per Anchises, in the underworld, that Rome is going to bound her power on earth. She'll enclose her seven hills. There are seven hills in Rome, and they'll put a big city wall around them, and they do that. Just so, Sibyl Mother, honored of Berinchus, wearing her crown of towers, onward rides by chariot through the towns of Phrygia, in joy at having given birth to gods, and cherishing 100 grandsons, heaven dwellers with homes on high. Turn your two eyes this way, and see this people, your own Romans. Here is Caesar, and all the line of Iulius, all who shall one day pass under the dome of the great sky. This is the man, this one, of whom so often you have heard the promise, Caesar Augustus, son of the deified, who shall bring once again an age of gold to Latium. Okay, so this is the big deal here in line 1060, that here's Caesar, and then, of course, Julius, and then Caesar Augustus, the son of the deified one, and Augustus as the promised one. What's he going to do? He's going to bring again an age of gold to Latium, to the land where Saturn reigned in early times. He will extend his power beyond the Garamants and Indians, over far territories north and south, of the zodiacal stars, the solar way, where Atlas, heaven-bearing on his shoulder, turns the night sphere studded with burning stars. At that man's coming, even now the realms of Caspia and Maeotia tremble, warned by oracles, and the seven mouths of Nile go dark with fear. The truth is, even Alcides, Heracles, never traversed so much of earth. I grant that he could shoot the hind with brazen hooves, or bring peace to the groves of Eurymachus, or leave Lerna affrighted by his bow. Neither did he who guides his triumphal car, with reins of vine shoots twisted, Bacchus, driving down from Nisus' height his tiger team. Do we lag still at carrying our valor into action? Can our fear prevent our settling in Ausonia? Who is he so set apart there, olive-crowned, who holds the sacred vessels in his hands? I know that snowy mane and beard, Numa the king, who will build early Rome on a base of laws, a man is sent from the small-town poverty of Cures to high sovereignty. After him comes Tullus, breaker of his country's peace, arousing men who have lost victorious ways, malingering men to war. Near him is Ancus, given to boasting. Even now, too pleased with veering popularity's heady air. Do you care to see now, too, the Tarquin kings and the proud soul of the Avenger, Brutus? This is Brutus who's going to go with everyone else and kill Julius Caesar, his good friend. The Tarquin kings and the proud soul of the Avenger, Brutus, by whom the bundled fasces are regained. Consular power will first be his, and his the pitiless axes. Now, this mention of the fasces in line 1101, that's the grain tied together with the arrows sticking out, that's one of the symbols of Rome. When his own two sons plot war against the city, he will call for the death penalty in freedom's name. Unhappy man, no matter how posterity may see these matters, love of the fatherland will sway him, an unmeasured lust for fame. Now see the Decii and the Drusi there, and stern Torquatus with his axe, and see Camillus bringing the lost standards home. Standards are flags. That pair, however, matched in brilliant armor, matched in their heart's desire, now, while night still holds them fast, once they attain life's light, what war, what grief will they provoke between them? Battle lines and bloodshed as the father marches from the Alpine ramparts down from Monaco's walled height, and the son-in-law, drawn up with armies in the east, awaits him. Sons, refrain. You must not blind your hearts to that enormity of civil war, turning against your country's very heart, her own vigor of manhood. You, above all, who trace your line from the immortals, you be first to spare us. Child of my own blood, throw away your sword. Mummius there, when Corinth is brought low, will drive his car as victor and as killer of Achaeans to our high capital. Paulus will conquer Argos and Agamemnon's old Mycenae, defeating Perseus the Aesid, heir to the master of war Achilles, thus avenging his own Trojan ancestors and the defilement of Minerva's shrine. Great Cato, who would leave you unremarked, or Cossus, you or the family of the Gracchi, or the twin Scipios, bright bolts of war, the bane of Libya, or you, Fabricius, in poverty yet powerful, or you, Serranus, at the furring, casting seed. Where were, though I weary, do you hurry me, you Fabi, Fabius Maximus? You are the only soul who shall restore our wounded state by waiting out the enemy. So here, Aeneas's dad,
Anchises is going through pretty much all of Roman history. And of course, when it's read aloud, as though it was written 1,000 years ago, it will seem like, oh my goodness, all those prophecies came true. Even though they know it's written in their time, it's absolutely marvelous propaganda. Others will cast more tenderly in bronze their breathing figures, I can well believe, and bring more lifelike portraits out of marble, argue more eloquently, use the pointer to trace the paths of heaven accurately, and accurately foretell the rising stars. So again, this is Anchises' speech to Aeneas from the underworld. Roman, remember by your strength to rule earth's peoples, for your arts are to be these, to pacify, to impose the rule of law, to spare the conquered, and battle down the proud. Anchises paused here as they gazed in awe. So this is the whole Pax Romana, the Roman peace that Rome is fated to rule. This is justification for the conquering Romans to subdue others. And you can only imagine what it would have been like for Augustus Caesar to hear this read out loud by Virgil. Then he added, see there how Marcellus. Now, Marcellus was a young man who was destined. He was going to be the heir to Augustus Caesar. Augustus Caesar became emperor in 27 BC. But 4 years later, in 23 BC, Marcellus, when he was still a young man, died. And this is just tragic, tragic, tragic. So goes the story that when Marcellus's mother heard this read out loud, it was so beautiful she fainted. See there how Marcellus comes with spoils of the commander that he killed. How the man towers over everyone. Cavalry leader, he'll sustain the realm of Rome in hours of tumult, bringing to heel the Carthaginians and rebellious Gaul, what we now call France. And for the third time in our history, he'll dedicate an enemy general's arms to Father Romulus. But here Aeneas broke, in scene at Marcellus's side, a young man beautifully formed and tall in shining armor, but with clouded brow and downcast eyes. And who is that one, father, walking beside the captain as he comes? A son or grandchild from the same great stock? The others murmur all astir. How strong his presence is, but night like a black cloud about his head whirls down in awful gloom. His father Anchises answered, and the tears welled up as he began. Oh, do not ask about this huge grief of your people, son. Fate will give earth only a glimpse of him, nor let the boy live on. Lords of the sky, you thought the majesty of Rome too great if he had kept these gifts. How many groans will be sent up from that great field of Mars to Mars' proud city, and what sad rites you'll see. Tiber, as you flow past the new-built tomb, never will any boy of Ilian race exalt his Latin forefathers with promise equal to his. Never will Romulus's land take pride like this in any of her sons. Weep for his faithful heart, his old-world honor, his sword arm never beaten down. No enemy could have come through a clash with him unhurt, whether this soldier went on foot or road, digging his spurs into a lathered mount. Child of our mourning, if only in some way you could break through your bitter fate, for you will be Marcellus. Let me scatter lilies, all I can hold, and scatter flowers as well, to heap these for my grandson's shade at least, frail gifts and ritual of no avail. So raptly everywhere, father and son wandered the airy plain and viewed it all. Now that I've just read that about line 1156, I think Marcellus may have had a young child next to him who was a grandchild, and perhaps that is the Marcellus who was destined to reign after Augustus. Forgive my lack of knowledge. Line 1203. So raptly everywhere father and son wandered the airy plain and viewed it all, after Anchises had conducted him to every region and had fired his love of glory in the years to come. He spoke of wars that he must fight, of Laurentines and of Latinus's city, then of how he might avoid or bear each toil to come. These are the two gates of sleep, one said to be of horn, whereby the true shade passes with ease, the other all white ivory, agleam, without a flaw, and yet false dreams are sent through this one by the ghosts to the upper world. Anchises now, his last instructions given, took son and Sibyl there and let them go by the ivory gate. Aeneas made his way straight to the ships to see his crews again, then sailed directly to Aecatia's port. Bow anchors out, the sterns rest on the beach. And that's the end of book 6.